Well, I want to start out talking about a big topic, and then we'll narrow it down a bit. You know, in this world, and when I say this world, I'll talk about this world in three ways of looking at it. In this world of politics and philosophy and law, politics, power, the power in the world, politics, philosophy, the world of thought, the way people think, the way people think about thinking, and then law, order, how the world is organized and we don't all end up killing each other or running into each other. So in the world of politics and philosophy and law, there are two terms. They're very familiar to us. There are two terms used to describe competing approaches, very, very different approaches to politics, very different approaches to philosophy, very different approaches to law. And those two words are, on the one hand, conservative, and on the other hand, liberal. And that word liberal is often in our modern day and age, a synonym for that is progressive. So in the world of politics, philosophy, and law, we view it from the either the conservative point of view or the liberal or the progressive point of view. That seems to be the way that a lot of people divide the world up. There are conservatives, and there are conservative approaches to politics, philosophy, and law, and there are liberal or progressive approaches to those things, politics, philosophy, and law. In the typical case, you might find an exception to this, but in the typical case, they don't agree with each other. There may be occasionally some overlap. But in the typical case, conservatives and liberals or progressives, as it approaches those topics, they don't agree. Sometimes they're in violent disagreement. They don't agree with each other. They seem to be in constant combat, the conservative point of view, the liberal point of view. And I'm going to be using those very same terms, conservative, the vocabulary. I'm going to be using the terms conservative and liberal or progressive in this sermon. But I want to give a disclaimer at the outset. I thought it would be important to say this at the outset, hopefully not to be misunderstood. I'm going to be using the terms conservative and liberal in this sermon, but this is not a sermon about politics. It is not a sermon about philosophy per se, and it is not a sermon about law. It's not that. But I'm going to use the term, so I thought I'd just get out of the way that this is not a political speech. This is not a political speech. But we're going to use those terms because those two terms could also be used to describe differences in another realm of life altogether from politics, philosophy, or law. I want us to turn our attention to a different way of viewing the world than any of those three things, politics, philosophy, or law. I think it's an even larger question, and I think it even is more applicable to the people of God than our politics, philosophy, and law. And the title that I've given to this sermon is Always Looking for Something New. Maybe come up with another title. That's one I've given it. Always Looking for Something New. Because this larger question that I want to address, that I think is more applicable to God's people than politics, philosophy, or law, it deals with what motivates people in the way they live and think. Now, that should be applicable to God's people. It should be applicable to everybody, but certainly to God's people. Always looking for something new. Now, we'll begin in the book of Acts, chapter 17. One of the characteristics of a group of people mentioned in the Bible is their intense interest in new things. They're always looking for something new, it seems. New ideas, new philosophy, new theology. They were the Athenians. This is Acts chapter 17 we'll be looking at. People from the city of Athens. And that is the way the inspired historian Luke described them, basically with those words, always looking for something new. Acts chapter 17, and that was not a description given in a real positive vein. Luke was not bragging on the Athenians when he used that those terms to describe them. If we begin in verse 19 of Acts chapter 17, and they took him is the Apostle Paul, They took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak?" He was saying things that they were with which they were unfamiliar. "For you are bringing some strange things or new things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean." And then this comes the money line of this whole statement. Luke says, "For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or hear some new thing." They were always looking for something new. One commentator, viewing this passage, likened the Athenians of the first century AD. He likened them to people of more modern times. This is a statement that Adam Clark. Now, when I say more modern times, he was talking about 200 years ago, so that was still a long time ago. But it was a lot more recent than the first century. And here's something he said. "This is a striking feature of the city of London in the present day." That's when Adam Clark lived. And he was just saying this thing about the ancient Athenians. They were always looking for something new. He said, "It reminds me of London today." And this was 200 years ago. "The itch for news, which generally argues that a person has a worldly, shallow, or unsettled mind." Kind of an interesting comment. If somebody, of course, according to him, is always looking for something new, it's indicative of a sort of a worldly, shallow, or unsettled mind. And he said, "It's wonderfully," not in the sense of goody-goody, but "it's magnificently present now," 200 years ago in London. "It's wonderfully prevalent. Even ministers of the gospel." He was talking about this world's churches, but it was an interesting observation he was making. "Even ministers of the gospel, negligent of their sacred function, are becoming in this sense Athenians, so that the book of God is neither read nor studied," the Bible, is even by ministers, he would say, "is not read or studied with half the enthusiasm as is the newspaper." And that's the comment he made about London 200 years ago. Now, this phenomenon is not limited or was not limited to the Athenians, even in the biblical record. This is not a phenomenon that was limited to the ancient Athenians. This being dissatisfied, bored with old things, that was not limited to the Athenians. Being dissatisfied or bored with old thoughts or old ways of living, old ways of doing, it was also a characteristic. It was actually a problem, not just a characteristic. It was a problem with the people of ancient Israel generally. So it's not limited to the Athenians, who were primarily Gentiles and pagan. It was common also, as we'll see, to ancient Israel as a whole, who, by the way, were also, by and large, pagan. Paganism and idolatry never was completely stamped out of Israel. But to paraphrase it, the always looking for something new approach kind of sounds like this. "You know, I've heard it all. I've heard it all before. I've heard it all and I believe none of it. I want something new. I've heard it already. I've heard it all already. But I don't believe any of it and I'm not convicted by any of it." Any old things. "I've read it all, seen it all, heard it all. I don't particularly believe any of it, old things. I'm kind of bored by it. And I'm not particularly settled into any of it. I haven't bought into any of it, so I want to hear something new. I've heard it all, but I'm convicted of none of it. I've settled into none of it. Show me something new." Now this, again, it was not just limited to ancient Greek idolaters. God's people came in for this same sort of description, the people of Israel, in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 18. So let's read that. Jeremiah 18, and we'll begin in verse 15. This is God's evaluation of his people, Israel. "Because my people have forgotten me." It's translated "forgotten" in our modern New King James. It also could be translated "put me aside" or "misplaced." Well, that's old. I don't need that anymore. I'll just throw that over here in the attic somewhere. I'm going on to something new. That's the idea. "My people have forgotten me. They've misplaced me. They put me aside. They don't put much value on me. They have burned incense to worthless idols or vanity, and they have caused themselves to stumble in their ways from the ancient paths. Now, in more modern English, in the old ways. They're stumbling around because they've left the old ways. You get the mental picture of somebody going down a highway, either on foot or in a vehicle. It's a fairly well-paved, smooth highway. But they're not content to stay on that road. That's the same road they're always on. They want to get out and explore. So they go off the road, maybe across a field, or on a very bumpy county road or something, and it's bumpy, it's not well-paved. They've gotten off the old paths. They want to get on a new path. So they've stumbled. They've stumbled in their ways from the ancient paths to walk in pathways, not on a highway. I looked up that same verse, how it's translated in a few other modern translations. Here are some other approaches to that latter part of verse 15. They no longer follow the old ways. They walk on unmarked paths. Another one has it, you've left the ancient road to follow an unknown path where you stumble over idols. Another one has it this way. They fail in their ways, leaving the ancient tracks to enter upon impassable paths. So if we turn back with that thought in mind, those are not compliments that God is giving through Jeremiah to his people. This is not a good thing you're doing. You seem to be always wanting something new, walking on new paths. You're not satisfied with old things. The things of God are old. Sometimes people get dissatisfied with old things, well-trodden, well-paved way. They want to get off the highway. And so in that same line, we go to Jeremiah chapter 6 and begin in verse 13. This again is an inspired message from God through Jeremiah. And he's evaluating, in this case, not the Athenians, but the Israelites. Jeremiah 6 and verse 13. Because from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness. And from the prophet even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. They have also healed the hurt of my people slightly, or only slightly. They're only doing a very little good, not a lot. Saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? No, they were not at all ashamed, nor did they know how to blush. Therefore they shall fall among those who fall. At the time I punish them, it shall be cast down. Okay, now those are indictments against God's people. The next verse or two tell us what the source of all these problems are. Why are these people doing these things that get them in trouble with God? What's the source of it? If we pick it up in verse 16, thus says the Eternal, stand in the ways and see and ask for the old paths. Again, the reason they get into all these troubles that he enumerates in verse 13 and 14 and 15, they're always seeking something new. They're not willing to stay on the old ways. The remedy is ask for the old paths, where the good way is, and walk in it. Get back on the highway. It's well paved. It's old, but it takes you the right direction. And it's easier to travel on it. Ask for the old paths, where the good way is, and walk in it. Then you will find rest for your souls. But they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to get back on the main highway. We will not walk in it. Also, I set watchmen over you, saying, listen to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, we will not listen. We're not going to listen to the old trumpet, the old truths. We're not going to travel the old ways. Not interested. Already tried it. Not impressed. Don't believe it. Doesn't work for me. Well, from that little passage right there, chapter 6 of Jeremiah, verse 13 through 17, the way we could maybe read that is five problems are identified. I just read them rather quickly. I'd like to go back and focus on each one of them. There are five problems identified where God says you're doing this wrong. But the origin of all the problems is they're not content to stay on the old paths. They always want to see something new. The way you could maybe paraphrase all of that is God is saying to his people who have this tendency, call them liberals, call them progressives. He says, don't always be seeking for something new to satisfy you, some new way. Instead, you should seek out and stick to the old ways, tried and true ways, be a conservative. In other words, what does it really mean, conserve, conservative? Well, to conserve is to keep something, not to throw it away, not to discard it, to keep it. You conserve, you preserve. Keep it around. Don't discard it. Don't throw it away. Protect it from being harmed. That's the really meaning of to conserve, or to be a conservative, to hold on to old, tried and true ways, not to become dissatisfied with them, not to become bored with them. In the language that I introduced this sermon to, be a conservative, not a liberal or a progressive. Because the opposite of conserve is to get rid of, to not preserve. To be a progressive is to always, fundamentally, to be seeking something new. Systematically refusing old ways, being dissatisfied. And I think he mentioned five effects of that. If a person has that non-conserving mentality, and the opposite would be a liberal or a progressive. Now again, this is not a political harangue. This is a sermon using terms that political harangues consist of, but we're talking about spiritual ways of thinking. Much preferable to be a conservative. Stay on the old ways. Conserve the old ways. But of these five things, the first one we found in verse 13, the symptoms of being a spiritual progressive or liberal, the first one was given to covetousness, even from the prophet to the priest. How does being a liberal or progressive spiritually, not being a conservative spiritually, how does that translate to covetousness? Well, I think it's a fairly direct relationship. Minds which are given over to rampant materialism. A covetous person always wants more toys, more goodies, more money, more material things. Covetous. Minds which are given over to rampant materialism have a diminished awareness of the value of old non-material things. Non-material things like happiness, contentment. People don't covet those things because they're not things, they're states of mind. People that are covetous, that always want more things, do not conserve a way of thinking and living that don't involve acquiring more goodies. You know, there's a famous line in American culture. Some people attribute it to the man named Forbes, Malcolm Forbes. He was a publisher, billionaire, Forbes magazine. It's alleged that he said this. So there's some controversy as to whether he originated or just said it. But since he was rich, you know, he got credit for it. But there's a way of living that goes like this. At the end of life, the one with the most toys wins. Malcolm Forbes or others. Life is all about accumulating the most toys. Yachts, mansions, trophy wives, just physical things, jewelry, gold. At the end of life, if you wanted to find a successful life at the end of life, the one with the most toys wins. Well, that does not conserve the notion that there are non-material things that are even more important. It throws that away. It throws that away. It doesn't conserve that notion. So minds which are given over to rampant materialism or covetousness have a diminished awareness of the value of old, non-material, spiritual considerations. Those are thrown away. That doesn't motivate somebody to be spiritually in the right place. They just want more physical goodies. And so it's a hollow and a shallow way of living. At the end of life, the one with the most toys wins is a shallow credo for life. It doesn't go very deep. It's not very satisfying. Not really. Well, let's look at the second symptom of not being willing to stay on the old paths there in Jeremiah. The second one is everyone deals falsely. That's the second part there, verse 13. Well, how does everyone dealing falsely have anything to do with always seeking something new? Well, I think here's the connection. A society or a culture or a generation where truthfulness, we're putting a high value on truthfulness. Truth and truthfulness are almost completely absent. I think that can be a victim of always seeking something new. Because the old adage, the best honesty is the best policy. Well, that's old. We want to find another way of interacting with people that is not based on that old thing of honesty. We're looking for another thing. Maybe we can get ahead by lying. Maybe we don't even have to concern ourselves about being truthful. Instead of, is what I say truthful? is what I say, will it get me ahead? Will it give me an advantage? Seeking some new way to interact with other people that's not based on that old-fashioned notion that honesty is the best policy. Because sometimes when you tell the truth, it can be to your temporary disadvantage. It can be to your you can't take advantage of other people in business if you tell them the truth. But if you can deceive them and lie to them, so I think there is a connection between seeking a new way, not based on the old notion of honesty is the best policy. Let's find another way to interact with people. Honesty is the best policy is so yesterday. It is so old-fashioned. It's for losers, is the way that thought goes. Well, then the third symptom of always seeking something new, of not being willing to stay on the old paths, is in verse 14, where there will be people saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Gullibility. Gullibility is an offshoot. People who are always seeking something new are gullible. They are suckers for fast-talking political leaders. Vote for me, and I'm going to show you a new way to peace and prosperity. My ideas are radical. You've never heard anybody else say these things. But a fast talker can get people to vote or support them in nonsensical ideas. But they're new. We've tried the old stuff. One of the offshoots or the fruits of always seeking something new is to be gullible about ideas or words from fast-talking individuals. The inability to really identify cause and effect. Here's somebody saying, turn over power to me or become a supporter of mine in some realm, whether it's politics or anything else, and I'll lead you in a new way. And it'll be better for you. Well, if you've dismissed old ways and the ability to see cause and effect, what this person is saying is nonsense. It can't possibly benefit me. That's the way I used to think. I'm going to think a new way. Maybe it seems like nonsense, but let's give it a try. So we'll follow this person. I think blindness in following ridiculous notions is a progressive or a liberal, in the way I'm using the term, way of thinking. Those who say all is well, all will be well if we try this new approach. Previous generations would have said this approach is nonsense, but we're going to try something new. Let's give it a try. All will be well. Peace, peace. The fourth thing that's mentioned there is they're not at all ashamed. The rhetorical question, well, when they committed abominations, were they ashamed? No, not at all. Not at all. The incapacity to feel or admit personal guilt. Maybe you've observed that as an increasing thing in our modern age. The incapacity to feel or even express shame or admit personal guilt. It goes like this. Yeah, you caught me. It was exposed, that which I did. You know, what I did and why I did it, it was right for me. In your mind, it might have been an awful thing, but it was right for me. No, I'm not ashamed for it. I'm not going to apologize for it. From my point of view, that is an increasing phenomenon in the world that we live in now. Things that used to cause people to resign in disgrace from positions of power. Again, not just politics. Leadership and things that used to cause people to resign in shame when they were exposed, there is pushback, vigorous pushback. Well, you might not think that was right what I did, but it was right for me. Now let's go on to something else. Were they able to say, I'm sorry or I'm ashamed? No, they had the incapacity to feel or at least to admit personal shame. It was right for me. Under the circumstances, it was right. It's so old-fashioned to say there's a one-size-fits-all standard. It was right for me, so get over it. No absolute standards. And then guilt is so yesterday. Guilt is so yesterday. You imposing your standard of guilt on me, I'm not accepting it. And then the fifth one, I think, is in that passage, actually appears down in the very end of verse 17. We will not listen. God has laid out the case of what they've done. They've gotten off the old paths. They're always looking for something new, some new way to get from here to there. go off-road. He's told them all the problems as he sees it, encouraged them to get back on the highway. But there is this stubborn refusal, stubbornness in the face of life-saving warnings. This is a close-minded pride. It's also, I believe, an offshoot or a fruit of always seeking something new. Even in the face of a life-saving warning, most people in human history, if somebody, what is an old reaction, an old-fashioned reaction to being told the next step you take is going to be to your death? Maybe you're blindfolded, and somebody's been leading you by the hand, and they say, okay, we're going to stop right here. You can't see a thing. Now, what if the person that was leading you said, you know, you're at the edge of a cliff. It's a 1,000-foot drop under rocks. The next step you take down this path, you're going to fall to your death. What is kind of an old-fashioned reaction to that? Okay, I'm not taking the next step. Stubbornly refusing not to refrain from taking the next step is kind of a new and crazy. It's a stubbornness that is self-destructive. All right, so we've seen the Athenians had this problem, always seeking something new. We've seen that ancient Israel, by and large, came into under God's judgment for always seeking something new. But this problem, biblically, is not limited to the Athenians. It's not limited to Israel. This is actually a problem of mankind and has been since the Garden of Eden. Since the Garden of Eden, this has been one of the mega issues of mankind, because God's ways are old. They are old because God is old. He's eternal. Eternal is as old as you can get. His ways and he are old. And it's always seeking something new, a new way to be happy, that is really the mega issue of mankind ever since the Garden of Eden. Mankind has not wanted to conserve, preserve, or retain spiritual truth. Mankind, by and large, for 6,000 years, has been seeking a new way that they define, not that old way that God has defined. Romans chapter 1. When you start looking at the Bible, or let's say the story of mankind, through this particular set of glasses, using this particular set of words, it's not that you have to really hunt for biblical examples of it. It's that you can't stop finding them. It's just everywhere. You can't avoid it, seeing it. Romans 1 and verse 28. This is an assessment by the Apostle Paul of not just Athenians, not just Israelites, but mankind. And not just in one or two generations, but in its entire history. Romans 1:28. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, to conserve, preserve, retain all that old stuff from God. Even as they did not like to conserve or retain God in their knowledge, but God gave them over to a debased mind and all that sort of thing. It leads to very bad results to not conserve or be a conservative spiritually, the way we're using the term. Always seeking something new, some new thing, new idea, being progressive, use the term liberal. It is really an absurd way of thinking. It's an absurd way of thinking, but it tends to be the general way that mankind overall has thought. It leads to futility. It's the progressive way of denying and ignoring the value of old things. Old things from an old God. It is not the conservative way of valuing highly old ways and clinging to them, of conserving them. All right, so that sounds pretty dire. The Athenians, the Israelites, all mankind. There is another side to this picture. There is another side. There are a few people. There aren't very many of them. Never have been very many of them. But there are a few people, in the way we're using the terms, who have been conservative. There are a few people down through history who have known God very well. They've been the people of God down through time. They have known God very well. And they have not avoided the old things. and tossed them aside carelessly, they have conserved them and clung to them with their lives. They've been, in this sense of the word, conservatives. And they have come in not for condemnation, but for praise. Let's look at an example or two of that. Isaiah 46. We've seen God's judgment on various groups of people for being liberal or progressive, or always seeking something new and rejecting things that are old. But what about his addresses to or evaluation of those who have conserved old things? Isaiah 46. Let's look at verses 8 and 9. Remember this and show yourselves men. Isaiah 46, 8. Recall to mind, O you transgressors, remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God. There's none like me. He doesn't change. His ways are old. But he says, to anybody who will listen, it's going to be much better for you if you conserve those things. You don't turn them aside. And there have been a few people who have done that. Let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy. I'm just setting the stage for this other side of the coin here. That as bad as it is to be a liberal or a progressive, as bad as are the fruits of rejecting the old ways, workable ways, true ways, it's good and produces good fruit to conserve those things. Deuteronomy 32. We'll start in verse 1. I don't know if it works the same way here in the East Texas congregation, but where I'm from, we get paid by the verse. So I'm looking for a full payday today. So my pockets will be bulging when we leave here. Deuteronomy 32, verse 1. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Now I go down to verse 3. For I proclaim the name of the Eternal. Ascribe greatness to our God. He's the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways. How would we describe, how have we been describing his ways? They're old. They don't change. Old ways. His ways are justice. A God of truth and without injustice. Righteous and upright is he. Verse 7, remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Another thought along these lines is conservatives tend to study history and draw the right conclusions of what happened back then. And say, let's don't repeat mistakes. The progressive or liberal way of thinking about life in general is that every day is a new day. Every day is a new day. What happened back then won't necessarily happen now. Cause and effect back then, it isn't the same. Things have changed. Everything's new, constantly new. He says, study history and learn the correct lessons of history and be blessed by the correct lessons of history and don't be cursed by repeating the old things of history. So remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. Now we skip down to verse 17. They sacrificed to demons, not to God. Well, that's a new idea. Here's our Creator. He made us. But that's old. Let's worship demons, other spirits who are in opposition to our Creator. That's a new, but a stupid, it's an insane way of thinking. But by and large, it's been the problem for all peoples. So, yeah, they sacrificed to demons, not to God. To gods they didn't know. To what kind of gods? New gods. We're tired with the old one, of the old one. New arrivals that your fathers did not fear. We see this problem of always seeking something new in the spiritual history of mankind. Of the rock who begot you, you are unmindful. You have forgotten it. You've thrown it away. You haven't conserved it. You've forgotten the God who fathered you. So this is an exhortation to learn true history and learn what really happened back then of value and importance in old times, to see the hand of God in old times and to realize, well, if people did that back then and God reacted this way, if people do that now, he's going to react the same way. So let's don't do that. So we don't want that reaction from God. We want a different reaction. Liberals or progressives, in the sense I'm using it today, don't learn from history. They basically ignore it or rewrite it. Conservatives study history and take away the correct lessons from it. And that's what this exhortation, I think, is all about. See the hand of God in old times and in his establishing of his old ways and revealing those old ways and conserve them. Now let's go to some examples of people who really do that. Like I say, there aren't very many of them in world history, but there are some. Psalm 119. It's the longest chapter in all of the Bible, and it has been called, this psalm, the footprints of a converted mind, because this is how converted people think. Over and over again are expressions of thought. These are the footprints left by a converted mind. But let's look at verse 52, Psalm 119, verse 52. I remembered your judgments of old, O Eternal, and have comforted myself. This is a conservative approach to history, especially of what God has done in history. I haven't just said, well, let's forget that and let's try a new approach. Let's try a different approach and maybe God won't be the same. He won't have the same opinions now as he did back then. See, to a liberal, not only are they trying something new, they're hoping that God becomes new and different. But he's not going to. He's going to disappoint because he's the same. We turn over a few more pages to Psalm 143. See, here is a person who is doing what he's supposed to do or she's supposed to do. Conserving, being a conservative in the sense we use it today in this sermon. This is Psalm 143, verse 5. I did remember the days of old. We just saw God saying, do that. Well, here's one person who did it. I remember the days of old. I meditate on all your works. I muse on the work of your hands. That's one of the great benefits of having the Bible. We can know how God reacted to various things in the past, and we can be certain he will react the same way now because he doesn't change. Psalm 139, verse 24. The way it reads in the New King James Version is this. See if there is, this is a prayer to God. See if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Well, that's true and good and helpful, however you understand it. But again, if we look at some other modern translations, that last part, the way that time has proven true, lead me in that way, the way that time has proven true, old ways, old proven ways. Let me conserve understanding in my mind of those things. If time has proven it true, it must by definition, number one, be old. And it must be a true old way. I think the prayer is, help me to conserve those lessons and those convictions from the past. Psalm 44. Verse 1. We have heard with our ears, O God, our fathers have told us, the deeds you did in their days, in days of old. We're studying history, the history of what God has done, and we're learning the correct lessons. All right, and we could go to many other examples where God's people have a tendency to do this, conserve understanding and conserve commitment to old things because they're of God and they're true and they never change. I believe we've looked at a number of scriptures that make it impossible to disbelieve that that's the message. But then there's a side thought or two that spins off of this that we might want to consider. Does all of this mean life must be boring? Does committing one's life to seeking and living old ways, does that mean it's going to be boring? And does it preclude growth? Is growth, excitement, freshness inconsistent with being a conservative? Does being a conservative means stale? It's the same thing all the time. No growth. Flatline. I believe it means none of that. It does not preclude growth. It does not preclude newness. It does not preclude freshness. It does not guarantee staleness. It doesn't do any of that. It doesn't guarantee boredom. This is one of the challenges of being young. Well, I don't know that problem anymore. I'm not young. But maybe some of you are young. One of the challenges of being young is believing this without having lived it. Old people can tell you that everything I just said is true. Because in our lifetimes, we've tinkered around with new things to see if there's a better way to do it than God's way, and there isn't. We know through experience there's no better way. When you're young, you have to take that on faith. You have to take it on faith that this is true. It's one of the challenges of being younger. Because life's experience hasn't taught you this. You must simply believe it because it comes from an impeccable source. But so one of the things you might think, whether you're young or old, does that mean I never grow? Nothing's ever new. Nothing's ever exciting. Nothing's ever fresh. Is everything going to be stale because it's old? A lot of the old things are stale, but not what we're talking about. These things aren't stale because they're old. They're as new as they are old. They're as exciting as they are unchanging. One example, Mr. Trebig probably experiences something along these lines, but every Saturday morning, get up, eat breakfast, and get in a car and travel 110 miles from Trussville, Alabama, to the Days Inn in Trenton, Georgia. I am the pastor of the Interstate 59 Church of God. Since I've been in Alabama, everything's been on I-59. It's the main artery right through there. Everything's always been on I-59. Our previous affiliation, this affiliation, I'm the I-59 pastor. The same road. It's smooth. It's a lot smoother than it was a few years ago because they've repaved it. It's major, but it's smooth, and it will take me precisely where I want to go, from Trussville, Alabama, to the Days Inn at Exit 11 in Trenton, Georgia. It's a very old way. Is that a boring drive? Same old road. No, it's actually not a boring drive at all. The seasons change. Sometimes the foliage is on the trees, and you get one beautiful view. Then you approach winter or, late fall, the leaf fall off the trees, and then you can see the stuff that's behind the trees, and almost every time we go, we see something that's way back in there after 11 years. Never noticed that before. Maybe a rough example or analogy, but it's one thing. There's a median strip on I-59, almost the whole way up. Sometimes it has trees, sometimes it has wildflowers, sometimes it has planted flowers. In the growing season, there's always new beauty. It's a new vista. It's the same road, but it's not boring. It's not stale. It's not unexciting. Different cloud patterns. As you approach Chattanooga on I-59, Trenton's just south of Chattanooga. If you read any Civil War history, the battle in the clouds, the Battle of Chattanooga, you can see what they were seeing in 1863, in the autumn of 18, I think it was when it was, the Battle of Chattanooga. Because those cloud formations, as you're driving along, it's new, it's beautiful, it's kind of strange. Every week it's something new. A rough analogy. But you can be traveling on old paths and it's not boring. There's newness, there's freshness, there's new things to see. So it does not guarantee boredom. God's old ways, they are true ways. They are forever true ways. And hence they will not change. But that doesn't mean there can't be growth and exciting developments along the way. 2 Corinthians 5:17 essentially promises that. We're talking about the conservative approach now, conserving old ways, but this is kind of an interesting assertion by God or the Apostle Paul in that context. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is an old, stale, bored creation. I didn't read it right, did I? Even along old ways, there's new. There's newness, freshness, growth. Now, being a conservative in this sense is about newness. He's a new creation. Old things have passed away, not the old things of God. But there's newness and freshness. All things are becoming new, or have become new. So it's the opposite okay, you've convinced me I'll be a spiritual conservative, but I'm preparing now to be bored, stale, and no growth. It's the opposite of that. We could also look at Revelation 21. There's an expression I just started noticing in popular discourse in our culture. Oh, I don't know, a few years ago, maybe you've noticed it long before that, but it's this expression, well, this is the 30,000 foot view. And I think the idea is, if you're 30,000 feet up in an airplane looking down, you get the bigger picture. You're not so much the minutia, but it's 30,000 foot view. Well, this is a 30,000 foot view, really, of the kingdom of God, of the whole plan of salvation. Verse 5, Revelation 21 and verse 5. He who sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. This is for conservatives. Old things, but it's within that context. All things are new. There'll be a new heaven, a new earth. Conservatism is not inconsistent with newness, freshness, excitement, or growth. It's not inconsistent with any of those things. Isaiah chapter 48. Didn't you used to be merciful and have a clock up here that told us how deep into this time we are? I'm getting nervous here because I'm timed here. Isaiah 48. Oh, remember the old... Oh, well, that would assume I could read that clock. Remember the old Spokesman Club days when I'm getting like five? Give me a five. Yeah, so, all right, Isaiah 48. Isaiah 48, verse 6. You have heard, see all this, and will you not declare, I have made you hear new things from this time, even hidden things, and you didn't know them. He's talking to his people on old paths who are conserving, but again, what he's being offered is new. 2 Peter chapter 1. See, we also get bonus pay, not only on how many scriptures, but how many times I make you go between Old and New Testament. So, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. We have the prophetic word confirmed. So even in the area of understanding prophecy, there are no new books being given to us of the Bible. It's the same old words. But over time, what's being promised here is there will be new insights, new understandings along the way from the same old words. We have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your heart. We're used to being able to wake up in our homes at any time of the night and being able to flip a switch on the wall and it's light. But back in these days, you had to have a little oil-burning lamp. And it would put out a little bit of light in the middle of the night. So if you wanted to know what was going on around you in the room in the middle of the night, 3 in the morning, yeah, you might have a little bit of light, an oil-burning light, and you could barely make out a few shadows. But as we get closer and closer to sunrise, there's more light being shined. And finally, the sun comes up over the horizon, and those electrons come into the room, and we can see very well. So gradually we'll have more and more insight, more and more light of what God has meant all along. So that's kind of an exciting thing. Over time we'll grow in our understanding, as God makes it possible, of even old prophecies. Let's go to the book of Psalms, chapter 77. I cried out to God with my voice. To God with my voice, he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God, and I was troubled. I was troubled. I complained, and my spirit was overwhelmed. You hold my eyelids open. I'm so troubled I can't speak. So in a time like this of great stress or trials, what did he do? I've considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. It's a way to deal with difficult times, to go back at arm's length, relearn or conserve in our minds the conviction of old things. And one of the old things is God never abandons his people. That's a very old truth. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever? Well, that's a new thought. Has he ever cast off forever? No. It's kind of a new thought that he would just abandon his people. Will he be favorable no more? Has he ever been favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Well, that's kind of a new thought. God self-identifies himself as a merciful God. This is a strange new thought that he quit being merciful, or he ever will. Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? That's kind of a new thought. God's got become forgetful. Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? And I said, you know, this is nuts. Those are new thoughts that I shouldn't give any credence to. I'm going to remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I'll remember the works of the Lord. And he goes back and he recalls history of God working with his people. And he never casts off forever. He may discipline. He may allow trials. He never abandons his people. That's an old comforting thought that we should conserve. Begin to wrap this up. So it's this very notion that old thoughts, old ways, true ways, are the one we should have our roots down into and be established in, and not constantly be dissatisfied with old things and seeking new things, that is the basis of endurance. It really is the basis of endurance. This very truth about God and his justice that so many people through history have wanted to leave behind and go on to something new. You might summarize mankind's history as a wish to consider a new way to live forever rather than God's way. A new way to have a good life that's new or different than what God has already laid out. That's a liberal, progressive, non-conservative approach to God and his truth. Perhaps, this is the thinking, perhaps we can find a new way where we don't even need that old God. We can have a new God. Think humanism. The religion of the modern world is humanism. We are our own gods. We have rejected old gods of old books. We are our own gods. Maybe we can find happiness and salvation and eternal life that new way. This perpetual search by mankind, not just the Athenians and not just Israel, for some new way, ultimately is a way of being worshipped instead of worshipping. We can make our own gods. We can become our own gods. We can worship ourselves, our thoughts, our new ways, and we can not have to worship that old God. It's a profound problem that the devil introduced into man's thinking in the Garden of Eden. Now, very, very briefly, I want to just give you some specifics. We've been talking about the 30,000-foot view, but let me just enumerate a few specific old things that God's people should conserve. And you could probably take my few and add to it many times over. Here are a few specific, really old conclusions that should be conserved. Number one, this is so old. God must be first in importance. Anything contrary to God's revealed will must be given up. That is an old notion. It's basically what God told Adam and Eve. Always look to me. I'll tell you a good way. I'll tell you what you should eat. I'll tell you what you shouldn't eat. Don't try to improve on that. That's old, but it should be conserved. The idea that God must be first in importance. Anything contrary to God's revealed will, it doesn't matter how good it looks, how pleasing to the eye, it should be given up. A second very old thing that should be conserved. Revealed truth is superior to conclusions arrived at by mere reason. God gave us minds. We can reason. These are incredible organs between our ears. We can think almost like God. We've made in God's image. And sometimes people can become very proud of their ability to think and reason and arrive at conclusions. A very old truth is, doesn't matter what kind of brains we have, how incredible they are, the conclusions of mere human reason should be subordinated to revealed truth. What is in this book should always trump whatever we reason or it appeals to our logic. It must always trump. One must always trump the other. A third very old thing, that there is holy time. The notion of holy time makes no sense to the human mind. Why are the hours between Friday sundown and Saturday sundown qualitatively any different than the hours, the other 144 hours of the week? It makes no sense to me. That's the way the human mind operates. But there is such a notion of holy time. It's a very old notion. You first see it mentioned in the second chapter of the Bible. God created a Sabbath. That's very old. It should be conserved. We should take a very conservative approach to the notion that there is holy time. Another one, righteousness is more important than popularity. Now again, I used to be old. All the old people in this room used to be young. All the old people in this room used to be young. That's a challenge of being young, really believing that righteousness is more important than popularity or acceptance, being popular or accepted. It's an old notion. It should be conserved. Another very old notion is that families should be structured in a godly way. There's governance in the home. Old notions. The father is the head. The parents, the head over the children. Respect going all directions. Very old notions. That has been discarded as old-fashioned in our world as never before. And we're trying all kinds of new models for family life. Progressive and liberal notions about family life reject the old notion. Father, wife and husband, children, honor and respect, obedience. Very old, very good. They're being rejected wholesale by the liberal or progressive, always seeking some new thing. Another very old notion is that returning to the old ways after having departed from them is possible. Well, that's encouraging. The person who gets off the old ways, even for many years, and stumbles around, it's a very old truth that there is a way back. And God will help people get back onto the old highway and will bless them. There is forgiveness. There is a way back. That's an old truth. It's an encouraging truth. You can't show one example in all of human history where a person who truly repented of getting off the old ways and wanted to come back was denied by God. If it was real repentance, there's always a way back. And then one final old truth. In this world, there are twists and turns and potholes on the old way. That is not a straight line from Trenton, or Trustville to Trenton. Even Interstate 59 does do this. Anybody who tells you that the old ways are easy ways, that they're always straight, that they're always level, or that there are not potholes in them. There are potholes in old ways. There are challenges. It's a very old truth to realize that the old ways are not necessarily easy. It doesn't matter if they're easy. God says they're the best way. So in conclusion, from the scriptures, we arrive at the conclusion that the people of God should study and be committed to and promote old things, old ways. They should conserve them. They should cling to them in confidence that there's no new, better way. In the end, God's people should be conservatives.